Appeals. It is December 2nd, 2020. The next case on our calendar for oral argument is the City of Shoreview versus Mohammed Amro. Council, as you know, we are conducting this hearing through Zoom rather than in person, but the same rules still apply. You will each have 15 minutes for your argument. Council for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You can see the time on the screen, I think displayed pretty clearly. If either of you have any issues with sound or visual as we move forward, please indicate that by raising your hand or otherwise getting my attention. It is important that you state your name and identify the party that you represent. And with that, counsel for appellants, you may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Patrick Kennedy, and I'm representing the appellants in this case, Spring Lake Park Gardens LLC and Mohammed Amro versus the City of Shoreview on an appeal of order denying a motion to vacate default judgment. The main issue in this case is the propriety of the default judgment order. In the first place, as Mr. Amro provided a written response to the City of Shoreview's summons and complaint on a motion to seek an abatement order of a public nuisance. The city adopted a resolution on March 18th of 2019 declaring conditions on the property a public nuisance, and then sought judicial remedy to enter the property and abate the nuisance. Mr. Amro engaged in dialogue with the City of Shoreview's attorney, obtained an extension of a deadline to provide a written answer, provided a written facsimile by that date, and then the city disregarded that written pleading, moved for default judgment without providing any notice to Mr. Amro or Spring Lake Park Gardens of any deficiencies in the written response, and obtained default judgment on that basis. We would argue that therefore the judgment is void under Rule 60.02 subdivision D, and therefore Mr. Amro is entitled to relief, and that the district court committed reversible error by declining to accept the one-page facsimile as an answer and by declining to vacate default judgment on that basis.
Mr. Kenny, just looking at the faxed page that says, I'm contesting the charges, it's not signed, doesn't indicate which of the defendants was submitting that. I mean, how does that comply with the rules in terms of what an answer is supposed to contain?
Rule 11 does provide that a party may issue a blanket denial. In that case, that's what we would argue Mr. Amro and Spring Lake Park Gardens did here. Mr. Amro is the sole owner and member of Spring Lake Park Gardens LLC, which owns the property. Therefore, while he may be prohibited from acting as an attorney and appearing in court on behalf of the LLC under Minnesota statutes, under the decision in Save Our Creeks, Mr. Amro was entitled to provide a written answer, receive notice of a deficiency, and be given an opportunity to promptly correct that. He did so upon notice of the entry of the judgment, which is the first actual notice he received of any deficiency. He enlisted counsel. He provided a motion to vacate default judgment, which was the proper procedure, within 3 weeks of the entry of judgment, and then otherwise complied with all the requirements in Save Our Creeks. While I acknowledge that the one-page facsimile denying all stating I'm contesting the charges is paltry, the city is not entitled to completely disregard that. Under Rule 11.01, there's an implied requirement that the defect of a lack of signature is a curable defect upon notice, and therefore the City of Shoreview was required to give notice that the lack of the signature can constitute a curable defect. With regard to whether or not
Mr. Kennedy,
yes,
he did get notice of the motion for default judgment. Why is that not adequate notice? You know, which is an opportunity to cure, as you say, his pleading.
A motion for default judgment is governed by Rule 55, and the implied notice of 11.01 is governed by a completely different rule. While there is nothing explicitly stating that they have to be separate notices, the fact that they are governed by different rules, we would urge, requires a separate and distinct notice and opportunity to cure. While, again, the written facsimile may have not complied with what a lawyer would consider to be a complete and detailed answer. To an uninitiated layperson, as Mr. Amro testified that he was through affidavits, that would constitute a sufficient indicia the intent to contest the charges, as he stated. While it may have not looked like an answer that we would typically see, the fact that the city of Shoreview moved for default judgment without providing that notice constitutes a violation of Rule 11.0, or constitutes a violation of Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure, and therefore it does not meet the notice requirements of Rule 11.01.
I mean, there's no provision in Rule 11 or any of the rules nearby about pleadings that expressly imposes on the plaintiff an obligation to give notice of the failure of the answer, is there? Where does this arise? This duty of the defendant to give notice, duty of the plaintiff to give notice to the defendant that it has failed to plead properly by filing an insufficient answer.
With regard to I would state that Mr. Amro did provide a written answer, a written response to the pleadings. While I understand that there is no express requirement that the party receive notice of a failure to answer under default judgment standard, under Rule 11.01, the plain language states, an unsigned document shall be stricken unless omission of the signature is corrected promptly after being called to the attention of the attorney or party. That implies a requirement to provide notice to the opposing party that the signature defect is curable and that the signature defect needs to be cured. There was no motion to strike this pleading because the city of Shoreview did not unilaterally determine that it did not constitute a pleading.
Wasn't that issue put before the district court in the motion for default judgment? The first sentence of Rule 5501 says, when a party against whom a judgment for affirmative relief is sought has failed to plead or otherwise defend within the time allowed, and then so on, and then it provides for default judgment. But by the defendants bringing a motion for default judgment under that rule, didn't that put before the court the issue about whether your client had failed to plead?
While it did put that matter before the court, we would argue that the missing intermediary step of notice deprived Mr. Amro of a meaningful opportunity to participate at this point in the lawsuit and to correct any deficiencies in his responsive pleading.
Okay. Mr. Amro, if I can follow up. So it's, Judge Gilligan made a determination at the hearing or following the hearing on the motion for default judgment that there was a failure of the pleading, that the document was not a proper answer. What's our standard of review for that determination? Is that de novo or abuse of discretion or something else?
That would be abuse of discretion.
Okay. Do you have authority for that?
I do. The abuse of discretion standard. It is in my brief. I apologize for not having that on hand at the exact moment. But it is reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard.
Thank you.
I just want to make sure I understand the factual record. You've asserted, I think, a couple of times that your client did not have an opportunity to respond to the respondent's Rule 55 motion. I'm looking at the record. I see the affidavit of Attorney Kelly, who's dated July 1st, that says, in fact, a mailed copy of the affidavit, notice, and motion, et cetera, have been sent to your clients, and the hearing wasn't until July 18th. Given that record, how could we conclude that your client didn't have an opportunity to respond to the deficiencies as laid out in the Rule 55 motion?
There are a couple of different answers to this, and I want to start with first and most importantly, Mr. Amro affirms that he never actually received that notice. Second, the notice of motion for default judgment and Mr. Kelly's affidavit state that they were mailed to Mr. Amro's last known address. That address is not specified. I believe on December 5th, Mr. Kelly stated that there was only one known address, but the affidavit of service does not specify what that address is. Third and finally, there was no notice to correct deficiencies in the pleadings, and Mr. Amro did in fact believe that he had responded at least to put the other party on notice that he intended to contest the charges and therefore answered under Rule 55. And I would like to mention something that I noticed in the respondent's brief, that the Farrington decision granting liberality to pro se pleadings, or at least the authority to grant liberality to pro se pleadings, it seems that the respondent is attempting to improperly narrow that decision to only petitions of writs of habeas corpus. Under Minnesota Statute 590, the Farrington decision was from 1961. Minnesota Statute 590 was not adopted until 1967. There's no limiting language in the Farrington decision to deny or only granting liberality to pro se pleadings in a habeas corpus petition. And in fact, this court has held that the Farrington decision applies to other civil matters, for example, employment, wrongful discharge, et cetera. So with that in mind, this one-page facsimile, again, though it may have looked a little strange to most attorneys, should be considered a responsive pleading, or at least should have put Mr. Kelly on notice that he had to provide a notice of deficiency to Mr. Amro. And again, I would urge that this court not state that a motion for default judgment meets the requirements of notice under Rule 11.01, since they are governed by completely different rules.
Mr. Kennedy, I want to turn your attention now to the question of, I guess, mootness, if that's how we want to characterize it. I mean, given what's happened in this case, what effective relief could this court provide?
The court could provide that the materials that were taken from the property be returned to Mr. Amro. The appropriate scope of the order is, again, at issue.
That had already happened.
Mr. Amro recovered some vehicles, but there was an issue with some dirt that we're getting a little bit outside of the scope of review here, but just for the court's information, there was some dirt taken that continued to be held in storage. Mr. Amro continued to incur charges on that, and the city continued to attempt to assess those against the property and against Spring Lake Park Gardens LLC with regard to the materials that were taken. The appropriate scope of the abatement order could have been contested, and in fact, I believe should have been contested and was contested by Mr. Amro, but he was not given meaningful opportunity to amend an answer, to proffer an answer on behalf of Spring Lake Park Gardens LLC. He was not given proper notice that his answer was in any way deficient.
But Mr. Kennedy, the other aspect of that question is the assertion that in fact the city acted when it passed the resolution ordering the abatement, and that was the decision that your clients should have appealed, I guess, by certiorari to this court. And so the ultimate question of abatement, that ship has sailed. How do you respond to that?
With regard to the city's determination that there was a nuisance on the property, I guess I will have to concede at some level that the factual determinations of the city of Shoreview that the nuisance existed at the time the resolution was adopted, Mr. Amro may have missed that opportunity. However, I would argue that the Shoreview City Code, section 210.020A, provides that Mr. Amro would have to be personally served with the resolution. He would have to, and the city could petition for a notice of summary enforcement with regard to a nuisance matter. The city did not do so here. The city brought a new summons and complaint asking for equitable relief under Shoreview City Code 210.020E. Yes, E. Seeking a judicial remedy after exhausting administrative remedies. Therefore, Mr. Amro was entitled to provide defenses. He was entitled to make factual challenges to whether or not the nuisance still existed at the time the summons and complaint was brought. He was allowed to argue the appropriate scope of the equitable relief sought and in other ways limit the nuisance abatement order. For example, there were some discussions in the resolution that vehicles on the property were inoperable and constituted a nuisance. Well, Mr. Amaro could present evidence that those vehicles were in fact operable or had been made operable in the interim between the resolution and the district court's order. He was not given an opportunity to do that. And the city, in fact, obtained an order stating that they could enter the property and remove the vehicles entirely. If I may clarify, the order stated specifically that the city may enter the property and abate the nuisance. Well, whether a nuisance remained or not is a defense that Mr. Amaro could have presented had the city provided proper notice and given him an opportunity to cure his defective pleading.
Mr. Kennedy, could you please summarize the evidence that was in the record about your reasonable defense on the merits in the record of the motion to vacate default judgment? The district court in ruling commented that you had provided only conclusory statements and had not provided any evidence that would defeat the allegations. What's your response to that?
There's evidence that Mr. Amaro was working with the city of Shoreview. The affidavits of Kathleen Castle show that Mr. Amaro was taking efforts to remediate nuisances on the property. Mr. Amaro's statements themselves, though they may be categorized as conclusory, are evidence of his intent and his actions that the district court could consider with regard to whether or not he was actually remediating the nuisances and taking efforts to comply with Shoreview City ordinances.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Council. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Council for respondent, you may proceed.
Hey, please, the court, Council. Joseph Kelly on behalf of the City of Shoreview, the respondent in this matter. We're here today on a review of denial of a motion to vacate a default judgment. Mr. Kennedy correctly stated the standard of review is an abuse of discretion on a motion to vacate a default judgment. Likewise, the decision to grant or deny the initial motion for default judgment is well within the discretion of the district court. And here, Mr. Kennedy laid out the factual background, but I think it appropriate to limit the motion for default judgment and then the ultimate motion to vacate, which was denied by the district court. In this matter, the background, as Mr. Kennedy noted, was over a year-long process of the city informing Mr. Amaro and Spring Lake Park Gardens LLC of nuisance conditions then existing on the property, made very clear what the appellants needed to do to bring the property into compliance with Shoreview City Code. And in March of 2019, ultimately declared a public nuisance and ordered appellants to abate the nuisance conditions. When the appellants failed to abate the nuisances, the city brought forth a district court action requesting judicial authority to enter the property and abate the nuisance conditions.
Mr. Kelly, I'm a little bit unclear about why it was necessary for you to go to court. You had a city council resolution, which on its face, maybe, allows you to do what you want to do. You also make the argument in the briefs, your brief somewhere, that appellant should have filed a writ of cert to challenge the ordinance. But then, was it necessary to go to the district court to get judicial authority to abate?
Judge Johnson, was it necessary? No, I don't believe so. But was it prohibited? No, as well, because under the city code, it essentially leaves it up to the discretion of the city how they want to proceed, whether they want to proceed based solely on their own quasi-judicial decision and rest solely on that, or do they want to then go to the district court and request authorization to abate the nuisances. And the city's default on nuisance conditions, unless they are emergency, they generally, they go to the district court because They deem it's essentially, they want court authorization to go in to enter a private citizen's property to abate nuisance conditions.
And then what law are you asking the district court to apply? Simply a Shorewood ordinance, or are you asking the district court to apply state law, statute or something?
Thank you, Judge. Yes. So in this, what we were asking the district court, pursuant to Shoreview City Code Chapter 210, authorization to abate the nuisances, and then likewise the statutory authorization to. So this is where it gets a little on the gray area, I would say. So it's the city can seek relief through the court through the process to abate it, because it's a nuisance condition, not a normal special assessment. That way it provides additional due process to the citizens after the fact. But the city statutory codes would in theory also under statute chapter 617 to determine an order of abatement, specifically 617.86 would authorize abatement of nuisance conditions. Now, the reason why that's where it gets a little grayer, because under 617, those generally aren't necessarily physical conditions on the property. Those are oftentimes behavioral conditions at the property. As noted in the City of West St. Paul matter versus Krangle, which had to do with the specific behavioral problems that were taking place, like prostitution, drug use, et cetera. Whereas these, because this is kind of a blend between the statutory and the city code, where municipalities have the authority to declare certain conditions as public nuisances. It did so, and then it followed basically through a blend of statutory authorization from the court for abatement, and also by utilizing the city code that has identified certain conditions as nuisance conditions.
So when we're analyzing whether defendants have a reasonable defense on the merits, we're looking at this only at the ordinance?
Yes, Your Honor, because in the statute, it essentially defaults to public nuisance conditions as well as a default, and public nuisance conditions can then default to the general police power of municipalities to determine what conditions are in fact a public nuisance. But getting to the actual notice that was received. So in this case, the appellant Amro, as the chief manager and resident of the subject property, and the LLC, Spring Lake Park Gardens LLC, were personally served with the summons and complaint. Appellant Amro did contact our office and requested an extension to file an answer, and that extension was granted. As noted, a one-page facsimile of the summons that states I am contesting the charges was received by my office.
Mr. Kelly, just so I understand, I mean, it was received on the date that the extension expired, correct?
Correct.
It seems to me that on that record, I would presume that you viewed that as a response to the lawsuit. But setting that aside, appellant's counsel suggests that Rule 11.01 obligates a plaintiff to advise a defendant of a curable defect. How did the Rule 55 motion advise the appellants of the defects in their purported answer and provide an opportunity to remedy that?
Thank you, Judge. So the Rule 55 motion for default judgment made it clear what the city's position was as far as the sufficiency of the evidence. It was based in part, the motion for default judgment was based that on the fact that the one page facsimile was an insufficient answer, not just in technicality as far as the lack of signing, but in substance as well. In providing that argument in the memorandum requesting in support of the motion for default judgment, and in providing a copy of that one-page facsimile that was a part of the affidavit of my affidavit to the court in support of my motion for default judgment, it notified appellants that that one-page facsimile was insufficient and had a defect according to the city of Shoreview, and had the appellants properly cured the defects and properly filed an answer prior to the default judgment hearing, we may have had a different outcome. However, no attempt to cure until after default judgment was entered into the record. And that's setting aside the fact that at best that this one page facsimile admittedly was signed by Mr. Amra, who's according to the affidavit, not a licensed attorney.
Signed? You say signed. I'm not sure. I mean, there was handwriting on it, but I don't see a signature.
I apologize. I meant unsigned. It was a one-page unsigned facsimile without the name, address, or phone number of whoever signed it.
I apologize if I misunderstood. But
that's my apologies, Your Honor. But a one-page unsigned handwritten document stating I'm contesting the charges on top of a summons was insufficient, and a court imposed requirement to call to the attention in a separate notice to a party that a pleading was insufficient, that would need some sort of timeline separate before a party can file for default judgment. There's no case law or rule or statute to support such a position. And in fact, that frankly is the whole purpose of a Rule 55 motion for default judgment, is to put the opposing party or the defendant in this matter on notice that the whatever document that was submitted was insufficient. Not just the motion itself, but the fact that the memorandum relied on that one-page unsigned facsimile and provided it to the court for the court to determine whether it was a sufficient answer or not. And the court independently found, without question, it is not, in fact, a sufficient answer under any reading of the rules.
I have a question which relates to the mootness issue. So you as the plaintiff say that, I think you're saying not just the appeal is moot, but are you saying the entire case is moot? In other words, if we were to reverse and remand on the merits, or excuse me, reverse and remand on the arguments made by appellant for reversal, would you then just voluntarily dismiss the case because you've gotten everything you wanted? Or would there be more things to fight about or to dispute and resolve in the district court?
If it were reversed and remanded, because the whole request was based upon conditions at the time of the filing and at the time of the abatement, but because those conditions don't exist, the appellant would actually be the one who would have an argument that the conditions are no longer nuisance conditions because they've been abated by the city of Shoreview, and the district court would essentially be making a determination on an advisory opinion because those conditions don't exist anymore.
But yet, Mr. Kelly, your complaint also sought an order permanently enjoining future violations. I mean, is that something that would render the existing judgment something other than moot?
No, not necessarily, because those are, I mean, if there are new conditions that were to take place that were in violation of the city code for nuisance conditions, that would be a separate set of facts, new conditions. It would be a separate cause of action. The city would have to go through an additional findings of fact through another quasi-judicial decision to determine whether, in fact, those conditions do exist. And if they do, that's a separate standalone matter by itself. So while I appreciate the question about the permanent injunction ordering the appellants in this matter to abide by the city code, I mean, frankly, that's a requirement for every citizen in the city of Shoreview is to abide by the code. It's a court order saying abide by the law, follow the law, which again, if there were to be a violation, that would have to be a separate cause of action by the city of Shoreview to determine that there was in fact a violation.
I'm wondering whether the appellant could get effective relief from this court because of paragraph 4 of the district court's default judgment order. And that paragraph says if the city abates nuisances, it may assess the costs of said abatement to the property taxes of the property. And I understand from the record that was done to the tune of maybe $15,000. So doesn't that authority for an assessment then give the party something at stake?
In theory, I could see that, yes, Your Honor. However, the fact is that the work was done by the city of Shoreview, which costs were incurred, and then the authority to assess said properties, the cost of the assessment, was appealed by the appellant in this matter, and they have a separate cause of action to determine whether those costs were reasonable or not.
But whether they're reasonable seems to be a different question from this, whether they are authorized to begin with. And I mean, they seem to be authorized by the district court's order.
Yes, Your Honor, they were in fact authorized by the district court order, which is not unusual for the cost of abatement, cost associated with abating a nuisance.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Your time has expired. Mr. Kennedy, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. With regard to certain portions of this, of the respondent's argument, especially with regard to putting the matter of the sufficiency of the answer to the district court through a Rule 55 motion, if the facts had been signed, the respondent appears to argue, then the court would deem it sufficient in substance to constitute an answer. By extension, the only way it would not be an abuse of discretion to determine that answer insufficient would be if notice had been given under Rule 11.01. Here, Mr. Kelly is not saying that has not alleged that he ever gave notice of deficiency outside of the Rule 55 motion. And in fact, in his brief,
why does the Rule 55 motion not satisfy the same purpose? I mean, and just to be clear, I mean, Rule 1101, I've looked at the rule more closely now. It says nothing about notice. It says unsigned document shall be stricken unless omission of the signature is corrected promptly after being called to the attention of the attorney or party. So certainly the Rule 55 motion for default judgment called to Mr. Amaro's attention the fact that this document that he faxed was not a proper answer, right? I mean, why is more formality or a different form of it required when the Rule 1101 simply says, refers to being called to the attention of?
With regard to, thank you for that question. With regard to the sufficiency of an answer in a pro se pleading, the motion itself did not state that the one-page facsimile provided was in fact deficient. All it stated was that the party failed to provide an answer. Mr. Amaro provided what he believed to be an answer, and in Mr. Kelly's affidavit, That is where the discussion of the one page unsigned facsimile came into play. It does not specifically call anybody's attention to the fact that the unsigned facsimile was deficient. It simply argues that that was not an answer. The proper way to do this, I believe, would have been to bring a motion to strike the one-page responsive document as an answer, but that was not done. Instead, the city of Shoreview completely disregarded the pleading itself, presented it to the court as kind of an afterthought, and stated that this was not an answer. The court then agreed, and Mr. Amro was not there to defend himself. And again, the respondent argued in its brief that Mr. Amro and Spring Lake Park Gardens, because they failed to answer, even though they provided a one-page unsigned facsimile that had curable defects, therefore was not entitled at all to notice under Rule 55. And then subsequently in this proceeding is arguing that by giving notice under Rule 55, that also complies with the calling to the attention requirement of Rule 11.01. They're essentially trying to have it both ways. With regard to
Mr. Kennedy, I know your preference has been to focus on the initial granting of default judgment, but let's talk about the motion to vacate, because I think it's clear that you brought the motion timely after entry of default judgment, and you know, I don't think the district court's decision turned on prejudice to the city so much as the failure to present a meritorious defense. And I know Judge Johnson asked some questions about this, but assuming that the answer was deficient, you could have obtained vacation of the default judgment by establishing, frankly, what an answer would have provided, and that is some indication of a meritorious defense. Why wasn't that proceedings at the motion to vacate stage sufficient to give your clients an opportunity to set forth their position?
Well, first, with regard to the order denying vacation of the default judgment, the district court did not make findings with regard to timeliness and did not make findings with regard to extensive findings with regard to prejudice, outside of determining that the issue of prejudice was moot because the city had already taken efforts to abate the alleged nuisance. With regard to a meritorious defense, the city of Shoreview essentially argues that Mr. Amro failed to keep his property within the Shoreview City Code and failed to remediate any alleged nuisances. Mr. Amro was not given a meaningful opportunity to present evidence to the court for the court to decide on the factual basis of whether or not Mr. Amro had taken efforts subsequent to the resolution declaring the property conditions on the property a nuisance to determine whether or not Mr. Amro had in fact remediated the nuisance already and whether the scope of an abatement order was appropriate.
Well, he had an opportunity to put in evidence with his motion to vacate, right? To put in evidence to show his defense on the merits.
Mr. Amro did plead some evidence and some allegations that he had taken efforts to attempt to remediate the nuisance. However, at that point, the city had already entered the property, removed several vehicles that Mr. Amro was using to remediate the nuisance, had removed a significant amount of dirt, truckloads of dirt from the property. And Mr. Amro was not given an opportunity prior to the entry of the city to present evidence that he was in fact working to remediate any alleged nuisance.
All right, thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. Thank you both for your arguments today. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. That is the last case on our court calendar for oral argument, so the court will recess to confer with respect to the remaining calendar. Thank you.